Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. Gray,
Al.
This is your sister-in-law, Al Pipitone.
Hi.
We were just talking about gear a little bit. You know I'm not a gearhead, but you were just talking about, at one point, you sold all your gear, right?
To go
to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Is that difficult to do?
Well, at the time, it didn't seem that difficult to do because we just figured we were going to make our fame and fortune in Florida and be able to replace all that gear no problem.
What city did you go to?
Orlando.
We're talking years ago. You were young. You were 20 or something like that.
1982.
Okay.
I think it was 82. At the time, around here in Buffalo, everybody was going to Florida at that point.
Really?
You know, because there were just so many job opportunities, whereas around here, you know, Republic Steel and Bethlehem Steel were all closing down around those times,
mm-hmm.
and lots of people were heading for Florida, and a couple of friends of mine and I decided to try it ourselves, but it didn't work out so good for us.
So this area was super depressed, right? Like the gray skies, no work, the thing that we actually both remember how bad it was, right?
Oh, yeah.
This might just be my opinion, but doesn't that sort of environment make for good songwriting and good music?
I have to say yes, for sure, you know, because especially in that time, it was hard to get a leg up just about anything you did. And most people, like I said, a lot of people were moving away because the opportunities there, the people that stayed were struggling. And I suppose when you're struggling that...
Yeah, like art flourishes in places where there aren't a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, and just, you know, looking at the art community in Buffalo today, even back then, it was thriving back then and it's thriving today.
Yeah, we have always had that going for us,
mm-hmm,
I believe. Yeah,
absolutely.
I got myself completely off track of where I wanted to start with this, but we were talking about gear, and you talked about selling stuff. And I had to sell a guitar once, an SG, and I think that's, I had to sell it because I needed rent, I believe. And I think I sold it for $400. And that's one of those things that, do you have any of those things?
Well, I mean, in particular, when we were talking about this amp that I sold to go to Florida, you know, once I got back to Buffalo after that debacle, you know, I missed that amp.
So you sold everything and you went down. It was a debacle. Why? What went wrong?
Well, I went on the backs of these other two guys that I knew that had this so-called friend that had a business down there that was hiring. And we met the guy, and he said, come down. When we got there, he basically said, sorry, I can't hook you up right now, but... you know, if you go down to the manpower at 6 o'clock in the morning every day, you'll find work. And that's what we did. And, you know, after about 2 months, 3 months of working at manpower, we decided to head back. We never did get the jobs we were promised. And
oh, that sucks.
Yeah, and the two guys I worked with, you know, they spent all their money partying and drinking and we're going nowhere. It's just a tale of don't trust your friends.
Yeah. Let's move forward right to now, because I know you play in my band. You have for at least 10 years, probably 15 at this point. I don't even know, right? And you've played with several other bands. I almost said Manowar. Morningstar, Fungus Among Us. You had your own band with Nat, Ego Jones. And then cover bands. There's like lots of cover bands, too,
right? Lots of cover bands, yeah.
Sugar Spoon, and now we're in Good Time Charlene.
Yes.
So what's an ideal gig? Like, what have you had ideal gigs, and what makes it, like, so worth it?
Oh, I think I've had many. I don't think it's the norm to have those type of gigs, but to me it's when you're playing well and you're feeling good about your playing and you're in the moment and not thinking too much about what you're playing and that the band together as a whole is working together and we're all on the same page and the audience is with us, and that to me is the ideal circumstance to be in, because then you begin to feed off each other as a band and off of the people that are listening as well. It becomes an experience for everybody.
Mm-hmm. So interesting that you talked about all sort of internal things. Like, you didn't say, oh, we're on a big stage in front of 5,000 people. I think it just strikes me as interesting, because playing music really is a personal thing. And so, like, you could have an ideal gig. It doesn't matter the place. As long as you can hear what you're doing and you can hear your bandmates, that's good enough for you. Is that what you're saying?
I guess so. You know, I mean, music never stops being a journey. You know, there's lots of bumps along that road. And sometimes you have real high spots and then you have low spots.
Do you think that's the nature of it?
Definitely.
Why, can we put that into words? Why is music so extreme of highs and lows?
Oh, boy. For me, it's a lot of it is challenging myself to perform what I have in my head to be correct.
Okay.
You know, if we're working on a song or a passage or a lick or a phrase, mm-hmm. something that is hopefully adding to the music that you're playing,
mm-hmm.
and to execute it well and to be able to listen to the other musicians around you and feed off of them and be a part of it all together.
There's so many variables in that, right? Like, that are outside of your control. A lot of things are inside your control, like you said, practicing and working on the stuff. And mm-hmm. then, but like, you're right that I could see why it could be extreme highs and extreme lows, because, as I said, there's so many variables at a live performance, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you could have a lot of the gigs that turn out to be really good start out really bad. You know, we're having trouble getting there and
okay.
setting up your gear, and you get frustrated and maybe you're having trouble with your bandmates or what have you, you know, but at the last second, once things starts moving, all of a sudden you're all together and feeling it together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it doesn't happen, but, you know, you're working to get to those places that lift you up,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a band or as a musician.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it makes you high,
yeah.
in your head,
yeah.
you know, that you are achieving something that you've been working on, you know, you and me,
yeah.
And many of the people we know all our lives working on music and trying to get somewhere, for me, just personally, to improve and get better, you know, all the time.
Which was actually one of my questions, which is that I guess what we figure out is, you know, you're never going to get to the finish line with it, right?
Like, right.
Once you learn one thing, there's 10 more you realize you don't
absolutely.
Know, right? Isn't that crazy?
But that's the beauty of it, you know, is that there is music is a never ending journey. That you there's always something to learn. There's always something that you can be better at. You
mm-hmm.
know, there's always mysteries out there that you need to solve and puzzles to be solved
mm-hmm.
Musically that just keep it going, you know. I suppose you could think of it almost like painting or drawing or something like that, you know, that you're trying to improve on, you know, what you're trying to show or say, you know, trying to take it somewhere that means something, I guess, you know.
There's a concept in, I think it comes from sociology, psychology. It's called the optimal experience and the zone. And whoever it was said that, you know, you're doing something right that's good for you, literally for your soul and your spirit, is if you kind of forget who you are, where you are, you forget all the your five senses, you're just in what they call the zone. And I think, would you agree that sometimes you can get there with music?
Yeah, I think you can get there a lot of times, you know. Music is just like everything else, with so many challenges that it has. Just getting to the gig at our age
mm-hmm.
is a challenge in itself, you know. But when you get those moments, like I said, it almost makes you high. It lifts you up. That you're right. You're not thinking about anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Things are just flowing.
Mm-hmm.
You're not thinking about the next chord or or whatever that's coming up. You're just living in the moment together as a band, or you know, could happen as an individual, you know, solo artist or something too. But to me, as a band, you know, you're like a team, you know, and team needs to be together, you know, and when you're all together on the same page, then that's really when the magic happens, you know, and that's when you get in the zone and you feel it, you know, and you walk away happy.
Yep. To say like, that was so worth it, right?
Right.
And you feel a little bit lighter and happier when there's good shows, right? It charges your battery, right?
For sure. And makes up for the other shows that are not not as joyful or happy.
Question, do you think there's an expiration date on what we do?
Oh, man. There just might be. You know, I mean, I thought about this morning. It's funny that you asked me about that, because I thought about that this morning when I was going to work, that you know, a lot of what you hear and see, at least as far as the music that's coming out these days, you know, I'm a guitar player. Very little of it in the pop scene is guitar-driven, where it used to be.
100%,
yeah. You know, and classic rock, rock bands, drums, bass, guitar is moving in, you know, going the way of the dinosaurs in a lot of ways. But at the same time, you know, I look at a place like Musician's Friend or you know, the
Sweetwater,
Guitar Center, Sweetwater, you know, they're just still selling gear hand over fist. You know, Gibson is still making tons of guitars. They're struggling, but Fender's still making tons of guitars. They're still selling guitars and amps. You know, people are still buying, obviously, because they're still interested in playing and trying to, you know, get to the point where we're at, you know, playing music in bands.
Yeah. My opinion is like the pendulum will swing back. Guitar bands will become popular again soon. It's just, it always has been, right? I hope at least.
No, I totally agree, you know. I mean, even look at the 80s. You know, we went through that. If you were to look at just the radio or just MTV, for example, back in the early 80s, you know, the synth bands and the pop bands that were coming through there, you know, if that's all you knew about music, you would say, yeah, guitar rock is dead, you know. But at the same time, there's this whole underground,
like the punk
rock
stuff
and metal movement that has been there, always been there, and will probably never go away, you know. The metal bands will always be there no matter what.
I just got handed a note from your manager, and she tells me that you have 15 more minutes.
Good Lord. Okay, thanks. Thanks, manager.
There you go. It's always something at these interviews, isn't it? Yes, we saw. Do you think that a good song never goes out of style?
I think that's definitely true. I think it's, you know, in fact, it's right here in front of me.
That's probably the most insightful thing you've said all afternoon so far.
A good song never goes.
Yes. All right. I have a question.
Truth to power.
What inspires you?
Wow. I think my family inspires me, you know. My kids inspire me, have always inspired me to work hard and do well and set a good example. I think that for sure. Music still inspires me. I love to listen to music, and I still love to play music. So that is, in itself, is very inspiring. Listening to or maybe watching a DVD or going to a concert and seeing some of my favorite people play or just my friends' bands around the corner in a crappy bar playing. You know, that's all inspiration to me. Yes, for sure.
Do you think, like, if you, this is kind of hard to imagine, but like, if you didn't have music in your life ever, what do you think you would be, or what would you have been?
I think, well, as a kid, I started out as an artist, and I just drew all the time, nonstop, drawing, pencil on paper. And if I wasn't playing music, I'd probably be drawing, you know, as an outlet for things besides work.
Yeah, a lot of people say that word outlet in these interviews, which is probably one of the things I try to remind myself is to be thankful for the fact that we get to play music.
Yeah, you're right.
You know?
Yeah, we should be thankful for that and that we're still able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And
hang on. Oh, it's still going. Keep going.
That we're still able to do it and we enjoy doing it, even though it can be a challenge sometimes. But, you know, we still have the spark. And as long as we still have the spark to keep going, then we'll do it.
Did you ever work an office job?
I did. Coming out of college, I worked for a newspaper in suburbia.
Was it okay, or was it soul-crushing, or somewhere in between?
It was definitely soul-crushing, you know, for me, because the person that ran the paper, owned the paper, was kind of a dictator of all things, had a heavy hand in everything in the paper, and made it very difficult to do anything artistic in.
In that word dictator, which syllable would you put the stress on when describing that person? First, the second, or the
D,
third?
I think. Yeah.
Okay, so you did come from a family with music. Your dad was a cornet player, yes?
Cornet and trumpet.
And did you grow up with him playing, being gone to gigs and all that stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did he know how to read music and all that stuff?
No, my father was just played by ear, but he was very good. Had a great ear and a great sense of melody and phrasing. And he was a Dixieland guy, jazz guy. Played trad jazz and straight jazz all his life. You know, as a kid, my dad would be in the front porch of our house with a stereo cranked up and just practicing trumpet all the time.
All the time?
Yeah, all the time. That was his outlet, you know. He didn't play that much until we got to be around maybe 10, 11, 12 years old. He started gigging again because I think he felt his responsibilities to be at home when we were young.
So when he was a young man, he played music?
He played a lot of music in college, did a radio show in Bowling Green. Jazz show in Bowling Green.
First, he got married. You said he stopped because he worked a regular 9-to-5 job.
Yes.
And then when you guys got a little older, he started gigging again. Did you go out and hear him play?
Yeah.
A lot?
Yes. Yeah, a lot.
What kinds of gigs was he getting back then?
It was mostly, it was all jazz. You know, that's what he was working on. You know, he had a couple of Dixieland style bands, you know, but he also played modern jazz as well. He enjoyed that.
What kind of places did they play at?
Man, we were at the Trough, we were at Garvey's, Cloister at one point. There was just, at that time, as I remember it, in, you know, the late 70s and early 80s, there was a scene in Buffalo for jazz and lots of jazz clubs.
I talked to George Scott from the Color Musicians Club about that, and you're so right. Like, he says the same thing. Well, really, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s and 80s are when it started to take a hit, right?
Right, and it's a shame because it was a very vibrant scene and really great musicians. You know, when BFO turned over to blues, I think that had a lot to do with it. Still, to this day, I wish that that BFO would devote at least some of their programming to jazz and especially the local jazz scene in Buffalo, because that was my father's main point
of
his radio show, was to promote local musicians and local gigs.
He hosted a radio show called Jazz Band Ball?
At the Jazz Bands Ball with Ted House.
With Ted House for 22 years,
22
did you say?
22 years, yeah.
And he would go host it live, right? Once a week?
Yeah, he did for a while, and then it came, he recorded a lot of the shows ahead of time as well. He did both of those things.
You know, Catherine Cook and Rebecca from Redheaded Stepchild, I remember when they first knew that your dad was Ted House, they were kind of freaking out because they grew up to that show and they loved to listen to it all the time. It was very popular.
It was a popular show, and you know, I listened to it a lot. My dad would talk about me when I first started playing guitar. because he really tried to push me into playing jazz guitar.
Oh, and really?
I was more into playing rock guitar, you know, but he would push me towards jazz, and he would call me out on the radio.
He would?
Once in a while. He said, oh, yeah, my son Gray, you know, he's working on guitar, and, you know, he's really getting good at rock, but I wish he would get into some more jazz, man. I mean, you know, so he'd call me out in front of, you know, thousands of people on the radio.
And I think you're, some people when they get older, they move into jazz, my opinion. Like, I know, like, so some people start with rock and then they transition into jazz, but I feel like you're happy in rock. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I did explore playing jazz guitar for a few years, and I learned a lot, you know, from that. Did the Berklee books with George Cain, you know. He was my teacher. He's a great jazz guitar player in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. Great guy as well. He taught me a lot. You know, that feel that you get on, especially on stage when you're cranking up a guitar and laying out a bar chord, and it just, you know, goes through every cell of your body, you know, and it's just, it's hard for me to resist the sound of loud rock guitar.
Yes, I feel you on that. I hear you on that. And do you think you got your work ethic about music from your dad?
Yeah, maybe. He always encouraged me, you know, that's for sure, you know. He even though I, you know, when I first started, I know how terrible I was playing, you know, it'd be, you know, always say, oh, that sounds great, you know. And he'd offer me some tips and stuff like that. For the most part, he stayed out of my way,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it was more like me sort of watching him and learning how he's doing it, you know, listening to him in the front porch as he's trying to, you know, cop a phrase or something from a record, you know, and go back over and over and over again, trying to get the proper phrasing down to it. I hear him doing that. So it was more, I guess, by osmosis.
Yeah.
Getting that.
Totally get that. I want to also talk about your profession as a piano technician, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And so you have rebuilt, you're Steinway certified, right? You've rebuilt pianos, you do piano tuning, so much experience. I know when you lived in D.C., you were the piano guy at a lot of famous places, right? And so what is it like to work in that field? That's an art. What's it like to work in that field?
Well, yeah, we think of it more as craftsmen in that area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, people could call it artistic, I guess, to a point, you know, but it's just like anything, you know, learning a trade and building upon what you've learned and getting better and better and building a reputation about what you do and moving forward from there. You know, I've been doing it since I was a teenager.
How did you start in that field anyways?
As luck would have it, my father knew a guy, Phil Georgia, who owned a music store, Hamburg Music Center in Hamburg, New York. It still exists. His son, Pat, owns it now, but he was a piano technician, and I don't know if my father had anything to do with this, but he hired me to work there, and, you know, I was the kid running around the store, you know, and I got to dust the guitars and vacuum the rug and empty the garbage cans in the teaching studios and all in between all that. He taught me how to tune piano.
Really? So yeah. He taught you that, like, sort of the old school way.
Right. I mean, there's really no substitute of working with someone who knows what they're doing, you know what I mean? And he was more or less taught me the basics and then let me run free. He was very supportive of what I did.
Mm-hmm. Was it constant correction? Like, because you probably made a mistake a lot, right?
Yeah. He would help me on more difficult things, you know, but he supported me all the way. You know, he gave me a pile of books and said, here's how things go, you know. And it didn't happen overnight. It took years to start getting good enough at it to start making some money off of it, you
mm-hmm.
know. But I worked for him for almost 20 years, and I started out knowing nothing. And by the time I got I moved on from the music store. I knew how to rebuild pianos, refurbish pianos. Just about anything piano related, I knew how to do once I walked out of there. You know, so I learned a lot.
Did playing loud rock music ever hurt you as a piano technician?
I always thought it probably would, you know, because your ears are your main asset.
Mm-hmm.
Every test I've had done on my ears, I've come out pretty clean and rosy.
Oh, that's
good. So far, so good. But I'm not getting any younger. I'm sure it's time to check them again.
This seems like the perfect opportunity to interrupt myself and Gray and talk to you all about being a piano technician, which it's now called, and it used to be called piano tuner. So I did a little research. And I found an article on a website. The website is called piano-tuners.org. This article is from Gil Green, and it's called The History of Piano Tuning. This article was written in 2004, and there's about 14 pages of information about being a piano tuner. But I went through and I picked out some super interesting things, like the history. So let me just read you some of this. This is from Gil Green again. Prior to the advent of the piano, most musicians tuned their own instruments. This was a necessary part of owning one. To call someone to tune a harpsichord would have been as preposterous an idea as calling someone to tune a violin for a professional violinist. A combination of factors made the harpsichord far easier to tune than the piano. There was generally only one string per note, and where there were more, they were easily isolated by use of the stops, while the strings were at a far lower tension than those of the piano. Does anybody understand that? Because I don't, but I think it's important. At first, ownership of the instruments was limited to richer families who employed musicians, or to musicians themselves. Either way, the musicians ended up tuning the instruments, the pianos. However, the setting of temperaments proved more difficult, particularly equal temperament. The Pythagorean comma, meaning that pure intervals alone being used would result in a wolf interval, wherein the beats left over from tuning the pure intervals accumulated in only one discordant interval, generally that between F sharp and B. Equal temperament took over from mean tone tuning, making all keys pleasant to play in rather than a restricted number, but it was more difficult for the amateur to tune. And as more and more amateurs were beginning to own instruments, tuning was becoming a task carried out by professionals. So the takeaway from all of that is, one, wake up from your nap, and two, tuning was becoming a task carried out by professionals. By the time of Queen Victoria's ascension to the throne, Britain was consumed by piano fever. We had cat scratch fever, the 1800s, and England had piano fever. As early as 1800, the piano's battle with the harpsichord seems to be nearing its end. The square pianos of the mid-19th century could reasonably be expected to remain in tune for around a month to 6 weeks in the British climate, but extremes of humidity and temperature could lead to even more frequent calls from the piano tuner. And that goes on for about six more pages. Okay, fast forward. The job of the piano tuner had been created by a gap in the market, a demand caused by the number of amateurs owning instruments, requiring maintenance, and leading to a need for visits from a tuner. Early pianos were of light construction, yet battling with ever-increasing demands of tension from piano players who wanted louder and brighter-sounding instruments. While the up-to-date pianos fared better, with stronger frames and heavier hammers being introduced, then, as now, tuners were having to deal with older pianos. Piano music itself was changing and making new demands on the instrument. Yet, people with old instruments were buying new music and requiring performances of their pianos from which they were not capable. And then, as now, the client was expecting the tuner to work miracles and transform their dated instrument into the latest one. The advent of bigger square pianos and of the grand pianos definitely discouraged all but the bravest piano owner from tuning their own instruments. And the career of the piano tuner was born. The growth in private ownership of pianos had created the need for tuners. Once ownership became more widespread, demand for tuners grew faster than the piano firms could supply them. All right, now let's talk about the social standing of piano tuners. The tuner would appear to have been working in the factory, yet not regarded as a factory worker. A plate in Wayne Brooks' Wright on the Broadwood Company shows a tuner at work in Broadwood's factory in 1842. He wears what would appear to be far smarter clothes than the other men at work in the picture. Although he's wearing an apron, he wears a dark jacket over the top, and rather than the caps worn by the others, he has a top hat sitting on what appears to be a frock coat, fully kneaded on an adjacent stool. This would imply that his day could be spent both inside and outside the factory, rather than the modern day practice of employing both in-house tuners and outworking tuners. Skip ahead. Generally, the tuner in the Victorian Edwardian age seems to have been regarded as something of a gentleman, since they were neither fish nor fowl when it came to classes. They were a breed apart within the factory. They were tradesmen, yet often came to the front door and conversed freely with the lady of the house and occasionally the man of the house, since they were working on one of the most prized possessions in the home. Next, I want to talk to you about a song called The Tuner's Opportunity, which was a favorite with audiences. It was a music hall song published in 1879. And let me just read you the lyrics. I'm not going to read you the chorus because I just want to read you the verses, which become the story of this piano tuner's opportunity. Here we go. Miss Crotchety Quaver was sweet 17 and a player of excellent skill. She would play all the day, all the evening as well, making all the neighborhood ill. And to keep her piano in tune, she would have a good tuner constantly there. And he'd pull up the instrument 3 times a week just to keep it in proper repair. He came there so often, I thought I'd complain that in March, April, May, and June, that tuner had been there once every day to keep her piano in tune. I said, he's too often there hanging about, and he's costing you no end of pelf. If your instrument wants such a lot of repairs, I'll attend to the business myself. But vainly I spoke to Miss Crotchety Q. She said, Fred, I'll do just as I please. And the very next time I called, I saw the tuner still fingering the keys. I said, get out. They said, get out yourself. And they meant it, for out of the place, I went with a foot, his or hers, on my back, and the door was slammed in my face. I got over my folly. I courted again, a bewitching but sensible maid. But I went in for tuning, and in less than a month, I was quite adept at the trade. Now we're married, and all my doubts and my fears are forever more laid on the shelf. For if ever her instrument gets out of tune, I am able to tune it myself. I hope you enjoyed that little introduction to piano tuning in the 1800s in England. Let's go back to the interview with Gray. Do you have advice for young people getting into the music industry in any way, shape, or form? Mm. What has been things you've done right in this business?
For me, things that I feel I've done right is to treat all my customers with respect and try to be polite and kind and understanding and try to do my best work and be there for them when they need you.
You could extend that to your rock music career as well, couldn't you, what you just said?
Yeah, I mean, moving forward, you know, just treating people well and hoping you get that in return, you know, and everybody benefits. I've always tried to get better at what I do, mm-hmm. even today. You know, I teach piano technology now as well, and I tell my students all the time that the piano is such a complicated instrument that it's always teaching you lessons, you know, mm-hmm. even at almost 40 years for me working on them. that I still get stumped once in a while, you know, and it's a it's sort of like playing the guitar, you know, it's a journey that'll never end. Mm-hmm. You can't know everything about repairing or working on piano, so mm-hmm. it's a never-ending journey, and that keeps it interesting. You can't know everything, and the piano will keep you on your toes, absolutely.
Has being a piano technician helped you be a guitar player?
I think so, yeah, because tuning pianos has a lot to do with listening to musical intervals. Thirds, fourths, fifths, octaves are in the mix, in the stew of tuning pianos, you know. So I think my ear has gotten a lot sharper from learning how to tune in a musical realm and recognizing, you know, I mean, early on, recognizing things like minor thirds and major thirds and what the fourth sounds like and things like that, getting set into your ear permanently, you know. Mm-hmm. So you know what, you can recognize it right away as soon as you hear it. So I think, yes, as far as musical listening and performing music, definitely tuning has contributed to, I guess, what you'd call your ear.
Does it hurt you? Does it physically hurt you when you're playing with somebody and they're like kind of out of tune?
Well, that's kind of a curse to being a piano technician and listening to in tune instruments, because it grates you a little bit when you hear things out of tune.
Yeah, it's like nails on a chalkboard or something,
it
right?
It is. And I mean, at this point in my career, in my life, you know, I can even recognize it on recordings. You know, I mean, for instance, Bohemian Rhapsody, by the time you get to the end of the piano work on Bohemian Rhapsody, the piano's starting to go out of tune already.
Really?
Yeah, and I can hear the intervals of the or the strings, certain unisons on the piano in that Queen song, that piano started to go out of tune by the end of the
awesome.
Song. And
that's,
I hear that all the time listening to music. I hear out of tune piano.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that.
Just is what it is, a blessing and a curse.
You're also a really good songwriter. I want to talk to you about that a little bit before we're done here. Mm-hmm. Your Ego Jones album, you have two, you guys did two albums. One of them for sure was released. Were both of them released?
No. The second one we had completed, and we were in Maryland when we recorded, and mm-hmm. we got moved back to Buffalo. And
yeah.
by the time we got going and set up, you know, there wasn't much money left over to dump into
pressing
and CDs
yeah.
and paying for artwork and things like that. It sort of went on the shelf, and I'll get to it, and I never got to it. You know, I ended up playing in other bands, and it just got shelved.
Yeah.
And now it's so far in the past that it's not really relevant to anything or anybody.
Okay.
But I do have it for myself to listen to and enjoy and take pride in what we got done.
Yeah. The first one that you did is really good, and that is still relevant. I still love those songs. Do you know if that's on YouTube or anything? Can people listen to it anywhere?
I have no idea.
We could maybe work on that. No
maybe
kidding.
We should, yeah. I'm very lax about my own music. I've written probably 50 or 60 songs. And out of those songs, there might be a couple handfuls of decent songs, you know. But I never really wrote a song that was really, really good, you know.
Actually, you have. I would beg to differ with that. Do you like songwriting?
I do. I think the creative process of doing it, my favorite part of songwriting is getting to the end. You start, you're inspired, you have an idea, you know, you got to mold it and build it into something.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get to the end and I listen to it, the melody, the lyrics, the chord changes, and I can listen to it as a whole thing,
mm-hmm.
that's the most satisfying part to me. Whether it ever gets played or anybody ever hears it,
that's like secondary.
Not as important to me as the creative process of doing it and then getting at the end and standing back and go, oh, cool, I did that.
Very interesting. I like that a lot. That's super interesting because, you know, people have different motivations for writing all the time, and everyone is unique, you know?
Right.
It's just interesting that, and you're right, I totally get that. If you were to tell me about, give me a few names of people that young people wanting to pursue music, who are some people who they should look into? Maybe it's a household name, maybe it's not. Someone who you think just sort of blew the doors off your world when you hurt them.
Oh, well, for me as a kid, you know, I grew up, my parents were not only into jazz, but they're also into pop music. My mom loved the Beatles. My dad was a Who guy. We had Steppenwolf, and we had Bread.
Oh.
Around our house.
I found her diary underneath the tree.
Yes. My parents had the stereo going all day long.
So who blew your mind?
Well, Who's Next was one. Mm-hmm. Just because, especially the synth parts, because before I was a guitar player, I was a pianist for 8 years. I took piano lessons, and I was into the synthesizer.
Okay.
And hearing the synthesizer on Who's Next, that just... I just couldn't believe the sound of it, you know. It sounded so cool.
Yeah.
I was just so mesmerized by it, you know. So there's that. But if I was going to talk to young people about getting into music, I would say that they should explore music that they don't necessarily know well. For instance, if you're into rap and you love rap music or hip-hop music, go back and start trying to discover the blues. Or maybe listen to jazz or big band music or an orchestra.
Who's one person that you could physically name in those, either big band or blues or jazz?
For blues, I don't know if I could name one person, but, you know, Robert Johnson, all the old guys, mm-hmm. Willie Dixon, those people that were responsible for starting it all and getting it all going. You know, it's very earthy, authentic, from the soul kind of thing. Big band, look it up. There's just so many, so many there. Classical music as well. You know, to me, I'd love Chopin. You know,
really?
Chopin is my guy.
Really?
When it comes to that, especially for me, solo piano. You know, that's something that I can delve into and spend hours with just listening to solo Chopin.
What does that music, when you listen to it, make you feel like?
Just takes my my mind away, and my mind and body and the feelings just flow with the melody. For some reason, you know, there's so many great composers throughout the centuries, but for some reason, Chopin really gets to me. You know, so moody is his music. You know, it can be very dark, you know, but very bright, but it's always super melodic, you know, and that's what I love about it. So I'd say Chopin.
Okay.
If you were a kid, go listen to some Chopin.
Listening to something like that, even if you don't really know what you're listening to, it might inspire us as to translate that into our own version of music, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. When I listen to classical music, you know, you hear like the Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
Yeah.
You know, that's very popular music, but that's very classically inspired. But the guys that started that were a metal band. It's metal based, but it also has the orchestral on top of it. You know, when I listen to especially orchestras, I can hear a drummer. There isn't a drummer. But in my head, I can hear a drummer playing along to the rhythm. I think a drummer would fit easily into orchestral music, you know. So I just hear that in my head when I'm listening to it, the percussion, the rhythm of it.
Yeah. Would you say Frank Zappa? Because his stuff is so orchestral, right?
Some of it's orchestral, some of it's rock, you know, some of it's serious, some of it's satire, you know. There's so much. Zappa is so far and wide and encompassing in his music that you could get just about anything you want out of it, jazz, blues, rock, orchestra. He was a great composer, you know, criminally ignored as a modern composer, and I think as the years go by, you'll begin to hear his name more and more. A lot of people weren't into his music because his classical style or orchestral music, because it's very angular, very abrupt. You know, you have to, it's very rhythmically complicated in many instances. You know, it's not easily digestible. So I think a lot of people walk away from it unsatisfied because it's not easily listened to sometimes. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he can compose some of the most beautiful stuff you've ever heard in your life. You know, something like Watermelons and Easter Hay from the Joe's Garage record. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the most beautiful pieces of music I ever heard in my entire life.
Really?
It just takes me away every time I hear it and almost brings tears to my eyes when I hear it. Mm-hmm. Those of people who are familiar with it will know what I'm talking about.
Okay, I'm going to check that out for sure. Tell me the name of that again.
Watermelons and Easter Hay.
Okay.
It's just it's an instrumental, a guitar solo. But, man, it'll tug your heartstrings, that's for sure.
I love that. Well, Gray, thank you. I want to say thank you, first of all, sure. for being such a good father to my niece and nephew and a good husband to my sister and
awesome.
For being such an amazing guitar player. And I've been so lucky to have you play in my band for so long. I really feel very honored that you've done that.
I feel the same. To be in your band and make music and create with you as well.
We're going to have to keep doing it, Gray.
I think we should. There's no reason not to.
That's right. So thanks for taking the time, and I'll see you as soon as I stop the tape.
Sounds good. Thank you, Will.
There you have it. Thank you for listening to this episode and to all the episodes of The Great Unsung. As always, I want to thank Shannon Furtak for producing this, and I want to thank my guest this week, Graham Howes, my awesome brother-in-law, and I want to thank my SUNY Fredonia students who did the last 5 episodes as part of their podcasting class project for their music industry studies. Stay tuned. We got more coming down the pike for you, and until then, stay well. Stay happy, keep listening to music. Until next time, this is Allison Pipitone and The Great Unsung.